welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston and all over the world, including South America, accessing the show on the internet. This week's theme is catered around the election, proportional representation and election chaos. Our guest this week is a familiar voice on Dialect Radio. He's Colin McNamee, who is the UKIP candidate for Bristol South, the United Kingdom Independence Party, I should say. And this week, he's here to discuss the pros and cons of PR, proportional representation, and the alternative vote system, as well as giving us his comments on a short audio clip about the amount of debt owed by various member states of the EU. We also have Cliff Hanley here to talk about his recent experiences on the Gaza convoy ship ambushed by the Israelis. Our features are usual, as usual, from Matthew Page and Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Grieve reads another excellent chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Trevor Carter will be here later, our resident bard, to read us his latest poem, and Jeff Sparks, as ever, is back in the studio for What's On and a Song of the Week. We also have June Burrows talking about the forthcoming Refugee Week, which starts on Friday here in Bristol and nationwide. I'm John Peters Coleman, and it's time now for a short extract from a recording made at a recent demo in the centre of Bristol for Power 2010, the National Democratic Reform. And then we're going to ask Colin here to comment on the points brought up by the speakers and chat a bit about PR and AV.
Power 2010 is a national democratic reform campaign which was started up at the end of last year, and they've been going around the country getting MPs and election candidates to sign up to their power pledge, which is a kind of a pledge of five reforms that people have decided they want to see in politics.
How much success do you think you'll have?
If I'm completely honest, I think that the main window of opportunity kind of closed when the Lib Dems agreed to go into coalition with the Tories, but we're still optimistic that we can, you know, raise kind of public awareness of the issues surrounding electoral reform. So yeah, I mean, we think it's very, very worthwhile, if only as an educational exercise.
So how long have you been in the movement?
Well, I joined Power 2010 in only about January or so, not so long ago.
And are you interested in politics generally?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I'm just starting a role with Take Back Parliament, who are the main group that have organised this event. But, you know, politics itself is very kind of hamstrung these days. Politics isn't what it used to be in the 70s, let's put it that way. So, yeah, I'm interested in politics, but I'm also aware that members of Parliament and local councillors don't have anything like the amount of power that they used to or they should do. So I'm more concerned with working towards reforming the kind of political process thing than getting involved in politics directly.
Do you think politics was more exciting in the 70s?
Do I think it was more exciting?
You said it's not what it used to be.
Well, I think politicians had real power in the 70s. I think that government has been diluted, really, through the process of privatisation, primarily, and parliamentary sovereignty isn't what it used to be. I don't know if it was necessarily more exciting. I dare say that the new Labour ministers thought it was quite exciting during the late 90s, for the last 13 years or so, but for the rest of us, less so, in my opinion.
Rob Telford.
Go on, Rob, then. Why are you here?
Well, I'm here because I think that our political system needs a lot of reform. It needs a lot of things changing, particularly the electoral system, which is the system by which we elect our representatives in Parliament. Oh, I'm here because I think that a lot of people are frustrated with our political system, which doesn't allow us to have adequate representation in Parliament. A party that got 23% of the vote got over 250 seats less than another party that only got 5% more than them. So it means that there's a lot of disparity in the way that our votes are allotted in Parliament, and we want to see a change to that system, to a proportional system of voting, so that you get a variety of candidates in your constituency and you can therefore have a lot of different views represented within our national government.
I'm surprised by how many young people there are here today. Why is that?
I just think that a lot of young people obviously are much more idealistic in a sense, because they haven't been part of the system for very long, and they want to see a change to the way that we have our voice heard. And our voice needs to be heard in the most fair way. With the current first past the post system in Parliament, a lot of young people are going to see that no matter how they vote, it doesn't matter because their vote's wasted. It isn't used to elect anyone. And that's only going to breed disempowerment and disenfranchisement. And we want people to be empowered. We want people to have power in their own hands, not in the hands of government.
Do you like to see a sort of younger members of parliament that liaised with the older one?
Not particularly. I'm more for reforming the present government. I think it's good to have young people getting together and showing views, but we want young people to get involved with parliament itself, not to just think of themselves as a separate body of people. We want young people to get involved with the current system, not their own.
So do you belong to a political party in Bristol?
I don't, no. I'm actually independent of political parties. There are a few people from different parties here, but I try to remain independent as much as possible because I think it's important that all parties see the need for this change and start to come around to the view that we need a proportional system, not the system we've got.
We're here with two gentlemen who've joined the demo. Can you just tell us a bit more about yourselves?
Yeah, well, tell me about PR. Tell me about AV. What's wrong with AV?
AV will just consolidate the two parties, Labour and Tories, in power. It won't allow the smaller parties to have
so
a voice.
Why would the Liberal Democrats agree to that?
I don't know. I think they've sold themselves down the river. I think that's unbelievable. I can't believe that they've agreed to it. It's not proportional at all. They will lose out. I think it's a big mistake.
That's interesting. I haven't thought about this before. I've got to study the AV one because I don't remember that one.
AV, my understanding is that each constituency, one MP is elected with 51% of the vote. But it works the you choose, 1, 2, 3, 4. So after the first round, the ones and twos go to the top. And then everyone else's number two choice gets added to them until someone is elected. I may have said that.
It sounds, yes, it sounds confusing.
It favours the two biggest parties.
The votes are transferred, as far as I know.
Yeah, but it will favour the two biggest parties. And I think the Lib Dems are going to lose out and they'll regret it.
So any party about the biggest two, you go for the second vote and then add those in. Because you see, I wouldn't put anybody down for the second vote.
I think this AV is a bit of a red herring and I'm a bit worried about it because the smaller parties are just going to get locked out for a lot longer now. And if you look at local councils, a lot more smaller parties are represented. I'm thinking specifically the Greens here. If you have a system that is truly proportional, people can vote for a range of parties and then they have to get together and agree on certain things. And I think that's much better.
I think it might be a better idea with Parliament if they actually split half the number of MPs, double the size of constituents, but have two. One to do local issues and one to do the actual national issues, because at the moment they try and do both. And I think it might be actually a good idea if they were actually separated those functions out and we could actually vote for people to do local issues and vote for people to do national issues.
That's covered by the council election.
MPs still put local issues in Parliament. You know, they do the local constituency work, as they call it. I don't know whether that would be a good idea to actually have them separate that, because they are talking about reducing the number of MPs anyway. And they were talking about PR for the House of Lords.
Well, we already have PR in parts of the United Kingdom. Scotland has it, Wales has it, and Northern Ireland has it. So what's wrong with England? Why can't England have it? Why can't the whole of the UK have it? I don't understand that. Yeah.
And it would put an end to the whole thing of voting for another party because you're worried about the wrong candidate getting in.
Tactical voting, yeah. That's a scourge.
After proportional representation, yeah. It would be truly reflect the opinions of the voting electorate.
I always think people should vote with their hearts and what they believe in, not voting to keep somebody out. You know, I don't think that's a very positive way of working a democracy. So that's why I believe in PR, proportional representation.
Now we have the choice of tactical voting as voters, but if you do with PR system, you then pass the tactical voting over to the Parliament itself. Because they, in a way, the coalition is a form of tactical voting. When you form a coalition, you know, you have to adjust what you believe to what is acceptable for the coalition. You know.
Hello, Colin.
Hi, John. Hello.
Nice to have you back with us. Well, what were your thoughts on the issues raised here?
Well, from that clip, there were several interesting points. I think overall, the growing interest and awareness of the weakness of the system, the political system and the voting system within the UK, considering we're supposedly the mother of parliaments and all the rest of it. I noticed that AV, which is the alternative vote, was mentioned, and also PR, proportional representation. If I may, I've turned up a couple of quotes relevant to AV, one from Nick Clegg. These are very recent, so if I go through them very quickly. Yeah. This is Nick Clegg in response to Gordon Brown, proposed political reforms, June 2009. I quote, "We can't afford to wait for a cross-party consensus because the Conservatives will never want to change this cosy Westminster stitch-up. People should now be given a say. A choice between the bankrupt system," that's first past the post, "a choice between the bankrupt system we have now, the timid option of alternative vote, a baby step in the right direction, and serious proposals for reform like Roy Jenkins' AV Plus, alternative vote plus, or better still, the single transferable vote. This is no time for his trademark timidity. Just get on with it." Now that was Nick Clegg condemning the alternative vote system. Also in June 2009, the chief executive of the Electoral Reform Society, "If Brown made this move when he entered office, it might have been viewed as welcome tinkering, but at a time when our democratic institutions are in crisis, a move to alternative vote would be nothing short of negligence. People are looking for choice and accountability at elections with a vote that might actually count. That simply won't happen with alternative vote." That was Dr. Ken Ritchie of the Electoral Reform Society, June 2009.
OK. I mean, the two-party system that we broadly have at the moment sort of bears a sort of resemblance in some senses to being in the spirit of the US rather than the EU, because most European countries tend to have versions of proportional representation or AV. I mean, how do you feel? I mean, this will drive us closer to Europe if we have versions of AV or PR, won't it?
Certainly not AV. It's an interesting observation you make. First past the post is the second largest voting system in the world. It's not only UK, it's the US, Canada, India, as well as France. Proportional representation comes in many forms, and that would be the largest voting system, but there is no single proportional representation system. And that's where a lot of the parties do not explain themselves when they're, such as the Greens or the Liberal Democrats, are talking about proportional representation, but which proportional representation?
Right. I mean, what are the different varieties of them?
There's about 11.
Okay, well, maybe do have time to go through all of them.
No, I bet. A simple proportional representation, which would be absolutely disastrous, is just to take the UK as a total entity and then proportionately divide the number of votes up and put it against the parties. In other words, the MPs so elected would not relate to a constituency. Another form of proportional representation would be apply the same system but within counties or regions. Mm-hmm. Now, we already have proportional representation with the European elections, such as in 2009. That is proportional representation on a fixed, closed party list. It's not an open system. In other words, the parties select the candidates, and it's the members of the parties, certainly with UKIP, the members in the UK, in the South West, vote for those people who are going forward within UKIP, and the highest number of votes within UKIP, so the candidates go on a pecking order, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to about 6. So that is a party list. Getting complicated enough?
It certainly gets worse.
But
given that there are so many different varieties, I mean, surely a referendum is going to be extremely complicated in terms of explaining all of this to people. How many people are really going to be able to get all their heads around this?
They're not going to explain it. The option will be one of two: first past the post or alternative vote. And alternative vote is exactly the system that Nick Clegg condemned in 2009.
He said it was a step in the right direction, though.
Well, we've had first past the post since forever with some very minor modifications. landowners moving to workers getting involved, women getting involved in the vote, but it's always been first past the post. The House of Commons is out of date. It was only ever designed for a two-party first past the post system. That's why you have a party and HM opposition. The alternative vote works on the basis from the electorate's point of view that they will cast one vote against a number of candidates. And it will then work on a regional basis as to how those numbers go until they reach 50%. So it is possible, under alternative voting, for a second choice candidate to actually become the MP.
Which do you think is going to be preferable to parties like the Tories and Labour, who are not going to want to lose some of their seats, as they fear may happen? I mean, the Tories, for example, like to have an overall majority. It's nice and simple. They don't really have to engage in complicated coalitions like they are at the moment. I mean, they're not really going to be that keen, are they, surely? Especially the Tories.
Well, I don't know anybody who voted for a coalition, actually. First past the post. It's interesting that when parties get into power, they prefer first past the post. Positive aspect of first past the post, that you get a strong majority, a strong government, you can drive policies through. So that's good. But on the other hand, you can go to the extremes of Margaret Thatcher with a strong strong government, as well as Tony Blair with a strong overall majority, and they drove policies through which were deeply unpopular. The opposition was just driven away. Now, not the alternative vote, but alternative vote plus, which came out of the Jenkins Commission, which came through from the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats in 1997. The alternative vote plus is a version a first past the post, but it also incorporates a part of proportional representation, and this is where it starts to get complicated. The one system which is easy for the electorate to understand is total representation, which is different again. It's genuinely democratic, and it's never even been discussed in the House of Parliament or by the Jenkins Commission. So TR, not PR, total representation, is worth looking at.
Okay, could you very briefly explain what that means to us?
Yeah. 650 MPs, 650 constituencies, you increase the size of the constituencies and reduce the number of elected MPs to 500. This is by way of example. Mm-hmm. They operate on first past the post. There's then 150 MPs, which then become party MPs, the constituency MP, and it's important to keep the link with the constituency. The party MPs are then elected on the number of votes cast across the country for a party, and usually the person who comes second within the constituency would then become one of the 150. So what you're now achieving with that system is genuinely the smaller parties getting a voice in Parliament, and as far as the constituents are concerned, the MPs are working within the constituency to get their votes.
Right, okay, I'll stop you there on that one. I mean, there's an incredibly bewildering number of options here. Very briefly, I mean, what did the UKIP, what did the United Kingdom Independence Party prefer, very briefly, out of all of those?
AV plus. I'm just pushing TR because I think it's a better democratic system. Okay, but you, UKIP, are AV plus.
AV plus. Well, thank you very much for coming in, and stay there because we'll come back to you later on to discuss some other stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Our first track this week is from Pink Floyd. It's called Money, and it's the introduction to a short audio piece. It's an Australian skit that featured on ABC, sort of based around Mastermind, and it's about the European country's debt. And although it's a comedy skit, all the facts in it are true. In case you're wondering why we tend to play a lot of Pink Floyd, it's because we have all the tracks they ever made, and usually one of them is topical or links in some way.
We'll be right back. And don't get me that do-goody good bullshit. I'm in a high-five.
Time now for John Clark and Brian Doerr with a few reflections on Europe's financial woes.
Your name is Roger, yes?
Roger.
Ah, that's your name.
Roger.
Good. And what do you do, Roger?
I'm a financial consultant.
Ah, financial consultant, eh?
Roger,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, terrific. And, Roger, how's business at the moment?
Not bad, thank you. Been a bit quiet lately.
How do you mean lately?
Since the war, been a bit quiet.
Fair enough. OK, Roger, your special subject tonight is the economies of the European Community. Mm. Your time starts now. Best of luck.
Thank you.
How much does Greece owe, Roger?
$367 billion.
Correct. And who do they owe it to?
Mostly to the other European economies.
Correct. How much does Ireland owe?
$865 billion.
Correct. And who do they owe it to?
Other European economies, mostly.
Correct. How much does Spain and Italy owe?
$1 trillion each.
Correct. Who to?
Mainly France, Britain and Germany.
Correct. And how are Germany, France and Britain going, Roger?
Well, they're struggling a bit, aren't they?
Correct. Why?
Because they've lent all these vast amounts of money to other European economies that can't possibly pay them back.
Correct. So what are they going to do?
They're going to have to bail them out.
Correct. Where are they getting the money to do that, Roger?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that one.
How much does Portugal owe?
Hang on a minute. What was the answer to that earlier question?
Just keep answering the questions, Roger. Where is Portugal going to get the money it owes to Germany if Germany can't get back the money that it lent to Italy?
Just a minute. What was the answer to the previous question? The question was, how can broke economies lend money to other broke economies who haven't got any money because they can't pay back the money the broke economy lent to the other broke economy and shouldn't have lent it to them in the first place because the broke economy can't pay it back?
You're wasting very valuable time, Roger. How much money does Spain owe to Italy?
$41 billion, but where are they going to get it?
Correct. What does Italy owe to Spain?
$27 billion, but they haven't got it. They're broke.
Correct. How can they pay each other if neither of them has any money?
They're going to get a bailout, aren't they?
Correct. And where's the money coming from for the bailout?
That's what I'm asking you.
Correct. Why are people selling the European currency and buying the US dollar?
Because the US economy is so much stronger than the European economy.
Correct. Why is that, Roger?
Because it's owned by China.
Correct. And very well done. And after that round, you've lost $1 million.
I've lost $1 million. I thought you said well done.
Yes, well done. You've only lost $1 million. That's an extraordinary performance,
I've
Roger.
I've only lost $1 million.
Very well done.
And that's quite good, is it?
Oh, it's excellent.
Sell everything immediately. Quickly.
I think it's called laughing as you sink.
Well, Colin's back with us. Now, you found that clip for us. What's your view on the situation? Bearing in mind all the facts spoken there are all true.
I think it's really a creative script. It's very cleverly done. It comes over as mastermind. The information on the debt, particularly within the EU and the financial and fiscal relationships between the member states, are fascinating. The speed and ease with which the information is put over, you certainly don't have to be an accountant, which I'm not. I know you are, John, but I'm not. And you can just understand it. The level of debt, if we think the UK is in a fiscal mess, which it is, it's a walk in the park compared to what's looming in the EU.
I mean, is this why a lot of people in the know are saying, oh, the problem in Greece, the debt problem in Greece could be, you know, the end of the EU and the euro? And a lot of people probably wouldn't really understand why, particularly.
The euro is not a single currency. It's actually backed by several issuing member states. There are 15 EU members of the euro. Germany is by far and away the biggest funder, but they don't back. So it's the only currency in the world where the issuing state does not underwrite its currency. And the reason for that is the European Union is still not yet a state, although it does have a currency, so it's not underwritten.
So what is the effect of that? What does that mean in terms of the debts that a lot of countries are experiencing, like Greece?
Chaos. Certainly, for the last 2 years, within politics, something called piggies has been talked about for, as I say, 2 years. Piggies, P-I-G-I-S. Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Italy and Spain. Those five countries have always been known to be highly suspect as far as their currency is concerned. And within the euro, part of the Maastricht Treaty means that one, supposedly means that one member of the EU or the eurozone cannot come to the fiscal aid of another member, and that's by treaty. So what's happening at the moment, there's a lot of manoeuvring going on to move the debt to the IMF, so the International Monetary Fund, which means members that are not part of the euro, the 15 member countries, such as America, China, and the UK, mm-hmm. will be required to put together a financial package through the IMF. So they're really breaking the Maastricht Treaty anyway.
Okay.
A financial mess. Remember piggies.
Piggies. Okay, we'll look up piggies, and thank you very much for coming in today, Colin. And sorry, we have to wrap it up a little quick there.
Thank you, John.
I'd like to welcome Cliff Hanley, recently returned from the Middle East via some unexpected complications, when the convoy ship he was on was ambushed by the Israelis, as you will have seen recently in the news. Hello, Cliff.
Hello.
So how long have you been back in the UK?
Since Sunday, I think we got back around about 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, Heathrow.
Yeah. And who did you come back with? Did you come back with some other people?
My fellow Bristolian, Sakir Yildirim.
Yeah.
And a friend of us from Gloucester. Well, they all came back together.
Okay.
Well, the whole bunch of us Brits arrived in one bunch.
Yeah.
And we were quite astounded to find that there were so many people waiting to welcome us. We thought there might be maybe 50 people with little flags. But there was, of course, a great big crowd at Heathrow.
So you've been quite surprised to find it's sort of in a very public national...
Oh, yes, indeed. Of course, we might as well have been on the moon when we were over there,
yeah.
in jail or wherever we were. We had no idea that we'd become big news.
So how long is it since you've been in Bristol? How long has the entire debacle taken? When did you leave?
We left Bristol on the night of the 20th of May, at a dreadfully late hour of 11 o'clock to head to Heathrow.
Yeah.
And we travelled overnight.
Okay, I mean, maybe this is like an obvious question, I don't know. But, you know, the journey is not without its dangers. Did you expect to be raided or stopped in such a way?
I think most of us expected that the Israelis would get up to something. They didn't, of course, want us to come. They wanted us to stay away. We thought perhaps the worst they might do was do some low-flying with the F-16s, or maybe shoot bullets into the water, do a bit of kind of bombastic big fright stuff like that. But of course they went right way beyond that, and that was a big surprise to most of us, if not all of us. We certainly didn't expect to get boarded and shot at fatally.
Okay. What was the mixture of passengers like? Because I know there were some Westerners who were like yourself, and then there were some Turkish people who was boarded as well. I mean, what was there, quite a mix? Did you all get
on
well?
Yes, there was a pretty broad spectrum of people. It was predominantly Turks. Of course, this particular convoy was organised by IHH, which is IHH's colloquial name. That's an international aid agency. A bunch of guys who do collectively what Superman did in the comics, but they do it in real life. It's only in the last 5 years that Palestine has become part of their agenda. It's gone to the top of their agenda. They don't get any funding from the Turkish government, but they're certainly backed by the Turkish people. And a lot of Turks came out and joined in, partly because of that. And I think the Turks have a very strong traditional connection with Palestine in any case.
I mean, certainly they're not going to be without their prejudice. I mean, how did you sort of feel about their involvement, given that there's going to be a political edge to their provision of aid, surely?
Well, we're all politically inclined. I mean, anything you do has got to have its political aspect. All of us, Belgians, French, Spaniards, Scots, English, Welshmen, there were so many nationalities all jammed together, not just Turks and one or two others. The last road-bound convoy, we were accused of being political. Well, to say that we were political is a bit like begging the question. Of course it's a political act. If you just go to Palestine as a tourist, that in itself could be seen as a political thing to do, because to a hardline Zionist, even to mention the word Palestine is beyond the pale, because there's no such place as Palestine. It's Israel. As far as I'm concerned, it's just two names for the one country.
Okay. The press reports that there were, you know, arms already on board the ship, and that they're sort of ready with their arms, sort of attacking the commandos.
Yeah,
so it was self-defence. So what was your immediate sort of minute-by-minute sort of experience from seeing the Israelis come towards you and then boarding the ship? Where were you? What happened?
Well, this story about there being arms on board was really laughable. One of my new chums is the next American Marine, who's renounced his American citizenship, and he's decided to be a Palestinian citizen. And he got badly beaten up in the airport as we were leaving. A guy called Ken O'Keefe. He got hold of one of the soldiers' guns, pistols, and just took the bullets out and chucked them away. He could have used it to shoot one of these guys, but he waved it around to show that he had it and chucked it away just to make a point. Some people in life anywhere tend to be more like fighters than other people. I myself, I'm a lover, not a fighter. I kept to the background when people started picking up sticks and getting ready for a showdown. I was running around the ship with my camera trying to get some good film, and I found myself on the middle deck when I was under the impression that all the soldiers were landing from the water rather than coming down from above on the helicopter. It's hard to tell what's going on everywhere in a situation like that. You can only see what's happening in your immediate vicinity.
Yeah.
So I was under the impression that all the well, certainly there was a lot of shooting coming from the sea, the machine guns and individual snipers. I got behind one guy with a handheld spotlight. He was training on the guys in the little boats with their guns, and of course they were shooting at him because he had a big bright light, and it was a very easy target. And as I was behind him, I was getting out some of the intention too, and that's when a bullet zinged off my arm, and I thought, well, you know, I could bleed to death here, and I wouldn't be doing anybody any good, so I got into the background after a while.
Okay. From what people could read, it seemed fairly clear that there were certainly sort of non-kitchen knives and arms and stuff on the boat that, you know, were not sort of, could not be intended for a peaceful purpose. I mean, did you feel certain this was just purely an aid convoy when you left?
Well, there weren't knives on board, but they were chopping vegetables all the time. We were doing our own cooking. There was a lot of food consumed. Tons and tons of food, and that's all it was, just ordinary kitchen knives.
Okay.
I've seen that photo that's been passed around by the Israelis. They found all the kitchen utensils and laid them out in a neat row on top of a I think it's a Hamas flag, as if to show, well, you know, this is these so-called peace activists, they're actually a bunch of terrorists, and these are their weapons. Well, that's a...
So how did the Israelis treat you when they got hold of you? Where did they
Well, of course, they're all, from my point of view as an ageing person, anyone who is under 30 looks like a kid. They're too young to go to the pub. But they were all boy soldiers. One or two were actually girls. They treated us with anything but respect. After we were searched and all our valuable items were taken away, and some people were actually robbed of all their money. It was really down to individual soldiers, what they actually stole or destroyed. We were made to kneel down in rows on the deck with our hands handcuffed behind our backs while a helicopter hung over very low, creating very strong gale storm effects, which made it very difficult to remain upright. That went on for three and a half hours. And the effect, after a while, it was nothing short of torture. And there's an extra aspect to that. They knew that when you have people in a dry, hot place and stop them from going to the toilet, which is something you do all the time without thinking about it, that's another way of making them vulnerable, way of wielding your power over them. If you wanted to go for a pee, you had to say, Yeah, but put your hand up, I'd like to go for a pee. Mm-hmm. And the usual response would be to say, not now, or later. Or if you were lucky, they would say, you can join the queue.
Which so what happened if you said no?
No. You just had to wait. It could be quite agonising for some people after a while.
Mm.
That's another form of mild, or perhaps not so mild, torture.
Okay. Did you have much interaction with other people who were sort of in the process of, you know, being jailed and kept whilst you were there with Israel? Were you sort of on your own?
Well, once we got off the ship, we went through a very torturous round of interrogation and searching many times. After that, we were bussed off to the Beersheba jail out in the desert. That was actually, ironically enough, the jail experience was quite relaxing after what we'd been through.
Okay.
We were doing nothing for a couple of days.
Right, okay. And lastly, what was it like with the effects on people back home? You know, obviously you're only concerned about yourself during the experience, but what was it like when you got back and met people who you obviously know and they were like...
Well, I'm sure I'm not the only one to have got a bit of a telling off from my relatives for giving them a bit of a fright.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, fair enough. And do you feel like any of this experience has really sunk in yet?
Well, yes, I think so. We had plenty of time to reflect on what we'd been through while we were lying around the jail.
Okay. And would you do it again?
Yes, I have said this already. I'll probably go again. I've said this in front of witnesses, so there's no getting out of it.
Right, okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing your experiences with us. Thank you very much for coming in. Well, our next feature is courtesy of Tony Gosling, our roving investigative reporter. Pleasure trips on the SS Waverley and the SS Balmoral are running again around the British coast, including our very own Bristol Channel, and the trips are run by a charity called Waverley Steam Navigation Company. Our Tony spoke to Tony Horn on board the SS Balmoral.
Hello, this is Tony Horn. A bit of history about this ship. She was built for Red Funnel steamers in Southampton by Thornycrofts, which is now part of the BT Group, or VT Group, I should say, 1949, and she's the last traditional kind of passenger and car carrying ship. She used to carry cars, about 12 cars on the after deck where the dining saloon is now situated. She ran for Red Funnel for 19 years, and in 1968-69 they no longer required this ship because they were going in for the big car ferries on the island route. And so P&A Campbell, the last shipping company that was here for many years in the Bristol area, took the ship on what they called demise charter, which meant that they had her for about 10 years. And at the end of that 10 or 11 years, they then bought the vessel about 2 years before she finally finished. But up until then, she was running all the traditional P&A Campbell trips in the Bristol Channel. P&A Campbell were a Bristol-based company originally, and they were started by two brothers, Alec and Peter Campbell, from the Clyde in the 1880s. They then left the Clyde and came down to Bristol and started operating some really good ships. And the early ones which local people remember would be Britannia, the Cambria, and the Westward Ho were the famous ones. They did have other ships, of course, and these ran quite successfully, very successfully in before the First World War. And then during the First World War, most of them were taken up for minesweeping, as were most of the other paddle steamers around Britain. Some returned, some didn't. So they then ran again from 1919 on to the 1939 war, and they were then taken up again for war service. And after the war, they built two new steamers. One was Bristol Queen, which was very well known in this area, and the Cardiff Queen. They sadly, times changed and money was very expensive to run. So in the late 60s, they were both sold for scrap. And this is where Balmoral came in. Strangely enough, her sister ship from Red Funnel, the Vector, became another Westward Ho 3 years previous to that. And this carried on until 1981, and then P&A Campbell couldn't run any longer. It was just financially unviable. And if it wasn't for the volunteer movement and the unpaid people that helped to operate this ship, there would be no steamers in the channel at all now. The Balmoral is here in the Bristol Channel from about mid-July to early mid-September. Before that, she runs up as far as they'll do a week, say, up in Northern Ireland, North Wales. She will come round the south coast and London in late June, early July. And then at the end of September, she will be laid up in Bristol, where the Industrial Museum is being redeveloped, and you will find her there, laid up, but don't worry, there's always work going on right through the winter until the spring again.
Tony Horn there, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling on board the wonderfully preserved SS Balmoral. Waverley Excursions can be contacted via their website, www.waverleyexcursions.co.uk, or you can give them a ring, 0845 130 4647. Over to Malcolm Grieve now for another instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell.
Secrets and Lies, betrayed by David Southwell. Today, the idea that atomic bombs do not produce radiation seems insane. When you discover that the people who actually dropped the first atomic weapons were behind claims that there was no radiation sickness, it's hard to know whether to laugh at their stupidity or be furious over their belief that they could get away with such a ridiculous lie as their official position. In the wake of the bombings, the US Army categorically denied reports of death caused after the bomb had been dropped, and publicly ridiculed anyone who mentioned the possibility of atomic sickness. Ignoring the ban General Douglas MacArthur had declared on journalists entering Hiroshima, Australian reporter Wilfred Burchett went to the city to see for himself the aftermath. He wrote a harrowing account of the destruction he saw. Tens of thousands dead. People reduced to shadows burnt onto walls, victims with the skin half melted from their bodies, everything reduced to ash and rubble. He also wrote about survivors who were suffering fevers, hair loss, and uncontrollable bleeding in the mouth and under the skin. The Daily Express printed his story with the headline, "The Atomic Plague." The article caused a worldwide sensation. To counter it, Major General Leslie Groves, director of the US Atomic Bomb Project, invited journalists to New Mexico for a tour of the first atomic bomb test site. The reporters included William L. Lawrence of the New York Times, who wrote a front-page story with the headline, "US Atom Bomb Site Belies Tokyo Tales. Tests on New Mexico Range Confirm that Blast, and Not Radiation, Took Toll." The Daily Express headline was much more eye-catching, as well as accurate. Lawrence received a salary from both the New York Times and the War Department. Major General Leslie Groves employed him to write press releases for the Manhattan Project. For his report on the tour of the site, Lawrence won a Pulitzer Prize, while Wilfred Burchett was expelled from Japan as soon as he was well enough to travel, after being hospitalised with a mild dose of the officially non-existent radiation sickness. According to the official accounts, the Soviet space program was a glorious triumph of superior technology. They placed the first artificial satellite in orbit with the launch of Sputnik 1 in 1957. And on April the 12th, 1961, Yuri Gagarin became the first human to travel into space. All rumours of accidents, dead or missing cosmonauts, and failings in the USSR's exploration of space were dismissed as inventions of a few organs of the bourgeois press. No one can doubt the safety of our space vehicles except those who purposefully spread cosmic lies. The Soviet claims were right about one thing. Many of the accounts circulating in the Western press detailing a road of Soviet slaughter to the stars were based on false names and information generated by the CIA. During the lifetime of the Soviet Union, details of its space program were kept secret, with the identities of their pioneering scientists never revealed, and even the massive operation of its failed attempt to put a Russian on the moon completely hidden. This allowed rumours to flourish. But in the era of Glasnost, space historian James Oberg established most of these to be false. However, the Stalinist practice of erasing people out of group photographs had been used extensively when it came to cosmonauts. The majority of these phantom cosmonauts could be explained, but not all. Some cosmonauts said to have been dropped from the program for health reasons and returned to the Air Force appear to have disappeared completely, whether as victims of covered-up failures in the space program or as prisoners in gulags, it is impossible to tell. The fact that all of the early space successes of the Soviets were down to forced scientific labour camps remains the most ghastly secret of the era. Even today, the full history of Soviet space exploration is difficult to obtain, but it certainly featured more deaths, crashes and setbacks than were ever officially admitted at the time, although not as many as the bourgeois press reported. On June 8, 1967, the American intelligence-gathering vessel the USS Liberty was anchored 14 miles off the Sinai Peninsula in international waters. The sea was calm, and there was just enough breeze to stir the stars and stripes the ship was flying. Were it not for the ongoing Six-Day War, the progress of which the USS Liberty was monitoring, the day could have been described as perfect. Then at just after 2 p.m. in the afternoon, unmarked Israeli aircraft began attacking the ship. For the next 75 minutes, fighter aircraft and Israeli motorized torpedo boats attacked the USS Liberty. Five torpedoes were fired, with one hitting the Liberty amidships, instantly killing 25 sailors. A total of 34 died in the attack, and 172 were wounded. The official Israeli account claimed, "Our Air Force attacked a vessel, and half an hour later torpedo boats of the Israeli Navy attacked the same vessel. During the attack by the torpedo boats, it became clear that the vessel thought to be an enemy ship was a vessel of the United States Navy. The attack was immediately broken off." Israel retains the official position that the Liberty was mistaken for an Egyptian horse carrier, that the attack was partially the fault of the US for operating in a war zone, and that the Liberty did not fly a flag. The USS Liberty displayed two flags. The bullet-ridden remains of both can be seen in US museums, and made repeated attempts to communicate with its attackers, the tape recordings of which make for harrowing listening. In recent years, at least one of the Israeli pilots has admitted they knew it was a US ship, but were still ordered to attack. Even given this, the official Israeli version has not wavered. Dean Rusk, US Secretary of State at the time, subsequently said, "I was never satisfied with the Israeli explanation. I didn't believe them then, and I don't believe them to this day. The attack was outrageous."
Thank you for Malcolm Greaves, Dread Alice Swindon, for that excellent reading of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and our very own Bard of Dalek Radio. Hello.
Hello, John.
What is in store for us today?
Well, it's a State of the Nation snapshot. It's called Messy Business. Government is messy business. Hard to know which act to choose. Whichever party wins elections, still the people seem to lose. Last big party, big corruption. Lose big money, make big debt. Election time brings interruption. House of Commons, changes set. So we get new coalition. Tories, Lib Dems, both condemn party of the hanky-panky. Say, trust us, we not like them. See, we sort the money meltdown. Trust the Tory, good old blue. We be old boy proper party. Stop the hanky-panky crew. Mr. Clerky's squeaky clean boy. Say we'll make all nice and new. Lib Dems condemned the hanky-panky, then they hanky-panky too. David Laws, the Lib Dem tax man, made mistakes in his own sums. This was not part of the new plan, so hanky-panky goes and comes. Must prepare for big time hard time. All the taxes need to rise. Bankers still continue cash crime. Nothing yet is big surprise. The Cleggeron says, ask the nation. Let the peoples all join in. Have a heap big consultation. Help decide whose job's to bin. Crumbly Labour look for leader. Now old Grumbly Gordon's gone. Millie Bland boys have agreed a thought that they may be the one. Diane Abbott, old-time lefty, threw her flat cap in the ring. Everybody's feeling testy. Who knows what the vote will bring? Meantime, people's not too worried. Summer is a-coming in. Have a nice time. Be less hurried before the tough, tough times begin.
Oh, thank you very much, Trevor.
Thank you.
Well, here we are with Jeff Sparks here in the studio. He's the man in black, complete with a Sepultura T-shirt. Hello.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 17th of June, and Eddie Martin will be performing with support from Sisters in Greece at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £7 in advance. On Friday, 18th of June, Brother Steve will be performing with support from Some Kind of Leader at the Barfly in Kingsway, Cardiff. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £5 each. On to Song of the Week, I feature Ladysmith Black Mambazo. This group, formed in Ladysmith, South Africa in 1960, released their first album in 1973 and are still touring and recording to this day. This is from the album In Harmony, which was released in 1999, and is a song titled Nomatemba, Mother of Hope.
Baby,
That was Ladysmith Black Mambazo with Noma Temba, Mother of Hope, from the album In Harmony. For more information, you can check out www.mambazo, that is spelt mambazo.com. Into Saturday, 19th of June, a big night out. We'll be performing with support at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. Also on 19th of June, Flash Harry will be performing with special guests Keith Warmington and Stuart Gordon at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 20th of June, the Pete Gage Band will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Clifton, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Before we go, let's hear briefly from June Burrows about Refugee Week starting on Friday.
I'm June Burrow, the founder director of the Pierian Centre, and we've been doing Refugee Week here in Bristol for 10 or 11 years, and this is our sixth year of doing it. Nationally, Refugee Week is now a really special week all around the UK. Lots of celebration, and the whole idea of Refugee Week is the cultural contribution of refugee and asylum seekers to the UK. So there are lots of events which are about food, about the arts, about different cultures. There's lots of projects now. For instance, in Bristol at UWE, there's Migrant and Refugee Hub, support for academics and people up qualifying themselves so that their qualifications can be used to teach or whatever in the UK. So there's a huge amount that goes on in Refugee Week about celebrating how much refugee and asylum seekers bring. And there's also quite a lot at the Pierian Centre here in terms of awareness raising. Refugee Action have a beautiful campaign going, which is part of Refugee Week, which is the Simple Acts campaign. That's also a national event. And anyone can find out about that on the Refugee Week website, which is www.refugeeweek.org. And if they want to join the Simple Acts campaign, there's a whole page there where you can say what you've done. So it's things like share a cup of tea with a refugee, read a book about a refugee, watch a film about by or about a refugee. There's lots and lots of these beautiful little things. And what Refugee Week are trying to do is to get everyone around the country doing lots of those simple acts that are not going to take a lot of time or energy, but raise awareness and get people really engaging with and welcoming and helping refugee and asylum seekers integrate into the UK.
Thanks to June Burrows for that. That's all from Dialect Radio this week. Our guests this week have been Colin McNamee and Cliff Hanley. Features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and Secrets and Lies was read by Malcolm Grieve. Poetry was from The Bard of Wimble Hill and Dialect Radio, Trevor Carter, and the What's On was by Jeff Sparks. Studio engineer was Johnny Royden with assistance from Mike Reed. The producer was Anthea Page. Until next week, it's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. Take care of yourselves.